Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
I'm Olene Walker, and delighted to be the chairman of this particular group. We're talking about a very interesting subject of which I know little or nothing, so I am here to learn as you are. The Canes of Martyrdom Healing, Relics of Joseph's and Hiram's Coffins. I'm anxious to get into that topic, and we have two experts here that I am delighted that you're going to be able to hear this afternoon. Robert Fillerup came to Utah by way of Montana and Wyoming, that great open country heritage. He received his law degree in the charter group of BYU's law school and has remained there. He currently is president of COCO, which prints the laws and information for lawyers regarding laws, not only in the state of Utah, but they are branching out across the whole United States. He does a great job in this area, and he is a historian by love, interest, hobby, etc. He says this allows him greater freedom than if he were to be a historian by profession. And we're delighted. He's married and has five children. I will introduce Mark, Wade Lillywhite at the same time, because he will follow the presentation with comments, after which we will open it up to you for questions. Wade Lillywhite is originally from Orange, California. He spent a brief moment in Utah at his birth, but it was very brief, 2 months. Grew up in California, is a rare book dealer. He's a member of the American Academy of Religion, Society for Biblical Literature, member of Utah Westerners, and the board of directors for the University of Utah Library. He is currently working on a biography of St. Peter and editing George A. Smith's journals. We welcome these two gentlemen here. It's a rare privilege that we have two such learned gentlemen, and I will turn the time over to Bob.
One of the conditions I set when I was pressed into service was that I would not have to prepare a formal paper. And so I do not have a paper. I am simply going to read some sources and then make some comments. Undoubtedly, the martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram Smith was a great shock to the saints and to the friends of Joseph Smith. A fellow by the name of Dr. B.W. Richards, who has been variously described as a friend of Joseph Smith or as an anti-Mormon who happened to be visiting there, and a former resident of Palmyra, in any event, was in Nauvoo and was in the Mansion House as a guest at the time of the martyrdom. And he left us a description of some of the events surrounding the martyrdom. I'd like to focus on a couple of those. He talks about the martyrdom in Nauvoo and then the disposition of the bodies after the martyrdom. Dr. Richards, Taylor, Hamilton, and a Mr. Southwick were the only living persons left in the town during the night, and they kept watch by the dead bodies. Previous to this, he's described how the town folk panicked, thinking there would be a raid by the Mormons, and so they abandoned the town. On the next day, the corpses, wet with blood, were put into boxes of rough oak boards, covered with prairie hay and an Indian horse blanket, and thus were carried to Nauvoo. He then describes the arrival of the bodies in Nauvoo. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day, the bodies arrived in charge of the marshal, Samuel H. Smith, a surviving brother of the murdered men, and followed by Dr. Richards and Mr. Hamilton of Carthage. They were received near the temple grounds by General Joseph Smith's staff, the Major General and staff, the Brigadier General and staff, and other commanders of the Nauvoo Legion, the City Council, and a vast concourse of citizens. The officials formed around the bodies, the masses silently opening to give them way, and as the mournful procession moved on, the women broke out in lamentations at the sight of the two rude boxes in the wagon covered by the Indian blanket. After describing some more of the outpouring of emotion, he goes on to say, the bodies were carried into the dining room of the mansion house, and about a dozen resolute men who could stand the scent of blood were selected to lay them out. This occupied an hour or more, and they were then ranged under the west windows of the room, and their families were brought in to take a first look at the dead husbands, children, and fathers. After describing that scene in great detail, he goes on to discuss the disposition of, or the preparation of the bodies for burial. The multitude dispersed about dark, and the next day was set apart for the people to come and see the bodies of the two brothers. They commenced assembling at an early hour, and the city, the river, and the surrounding country swarmed with men and women during the whole day. The scene around the bodies of the dead men was too horrible to witness. Hiram was shot in the brain and bled none, but by noon his body was so swollen, the neck and face forming one bloated mass, that no one could recognize it. Joseph's blood continued to pour out of his wounds, which had been filled with cotton. The muscles relaxed, and the gory fluid trickled down on the floor and formed in puddles across the room. Tar, vinegar, and sugar were kept burning on the stove to enable persons to stay in the apartment. In order to see the bodies, thousands passed in one door and out another. From morning until night, they came and went, and in the house for the livelong day, the lament of sorrow was heard. The rooms were then cleared, and the bodies put in coffins and concealed in a small closet opening from the dining hall. Two bags of sand had been prepared, and also two rough outside coffins into which the others were apparently to be put. But instead of that, these outside boxes received the bags of sand and were sealed up. He goes on to describe then the funeral procession and the burial of these two outside boxes that were made, that were buried or filled with sand. He then describes the burial of the actual bodies. And then he, let me read that. About midnight, the coffins containing the bodies were taken from the mansion by Dimmick B. Huntington, Edward Hunter, William D. Huntington, William Marks, Jonathan H. Holmes, Gilbert Goldsmith, Alpheus Cutler, Lorenzo D. Wasson, and Philip B. Lewis, preceded by James Emmett as guard with his musket. Talks about them going then down along the river and the foundation of the Nauvoo House and burying the bodies. Those bodies were then moved sometime later. The bodies remained in the cellar of the Nauvoo House where they were buried until the fall, when they were removed by Dimmick B. Huntington, William D. Huntington, Jonathan H. Holmes, and Gilbert Goldsmith at Emma's request. From that account, we can discern that the bodies of Joseph and Hiram were in at least three different boxes or coffins. The original boxes that were built in Carthage to bring the bodies to Nauvoo, the coffins that were then prepared for the bodies to rest in the viewing, and then the outside boxes of those coffins from which those inner coffins were removed. An eyewitness, or essentially an eyewitness to the martyrdom, a fellow by the name of William R. Hamilton, wrote a letter some years later describing in detail some of the events surrounding the martyrdom. He indicated that he was only 14 years old. He indicated he was probably the first person in the jail and up into the room where Hiram was after the martyrdom. In a letter that he had written to S.H.B. Smith, the son of Samuel Smith, he indicated the following. Soon after the killing of the Smiths, father, meaning his father, Mr. Hamilton, who owned the Hamilton Hotel in Carthage, father had the bodies brought over to our house and rough pine coffins made in which they were placed. And then he, in quotes, he makes this statement. The boards have furnished materials for thousands of walking canes, end of quote. Heber C. Kimball, in a speech given in Salt Lake City, in the 1850s made the following comment. This is rather long, so I hope you bear with me. How much would you give for even a cane that Father Abraham had used, or a coat or a ring that the Savior had worn? The rough oak boxes in which the bodies of Joseph and Hiram were brought from Carthage were made into canes and other articles. I have a cane made from the plank of one of those boxes. So has Brother Brigham and a great many others, and we prize them highly and esteem them a great blessing. I want to carefully preserve my cane, and when I am done with it here, I shall hand it down to my heir with instructions to him to do the same. And the day will come when there will be multitudes who will be healed and blessed through the instrumentality of those canes. And the devil cannot overcome those who have them in consequence of their faith and confidence in the virtues connected with them. Some do not appreciate these things, nor the counsels of their leaders. And then again, many do appreciate Brother Brigham. They love him and his counsels, and his words are jewels to them. When persons do not care anything about his words, what do they care about mine? And if they do not care for his words, they will not care for those of my those of any righteous man. If I had those relics of Abraham and the Savior which I have mentioned, I would give a great deal for them. In England, when not in a situation to go, I have blessed my handkerchief and asked God to sanction it and fill it with life and power, and sent it to the sick, and hundreds have been healed by it. In like manner, I have sent my cane. Dr. Richards used to lay his old black cane on a person's head, and that person has been healed through its instrumentality by the power of God. I have known Joseph hundreds of times to send his handkerchief to the sick, and they have been healed. There are persons in this congregation who have been healed by throwing my old cloak on their beds. In the life of Heber C. Kimball, essentially that statement is quoted with this footnote. It says, this cane is now in the possession of Bishop Abram A. Kimball, who testifies that healing virtues attach to it. Oliver B. Huntington left this account in his journal. He talks about a meeting that he had with some people. Oliver B. Huntington was frequently called upon to give firesides, for lack of a better term, groups of saints, and he would talk to them. One occasion he says this, I had with me a cane made of the rough box hastily nailed together into which the prophet Joseph Smith's body was placed after he was murdered and brought to Nauvoo from Carthage. In the top of the cane was a lock of his hair, which was taken from his head after he had been buried 7 months. My brother William took it off his head as he and my brother Dimmick were moving the bodies of Joseph and Hiram from where they were first buried in the cellar of the Nauvoo house to the cellar or pit under a little outhouse that was built exclusively for that purpose. Need to know that the word outhouse there doesn't mean what you, the common, that was an outbuilding. It was in fact the little spring house where they kept ice and their butter and so forth. The glass over his face was broken, and they saved some of that glass, and a piece of that glass covered the hair in the top of the cane, and then a piece of metal with a round hole in the center was over the glass and hair. Through the hole in the metal, the hair could be seen. At the party on that evening, the cane and its history became known and was viewed, inspected, admired, and handled by each individual, and was constantly on the move until 12 o'clock at night. I was invited to give a history of the cane and of the burial and reburial of the bodies of Joseph and Hiram Smith, which I did. The cane came into my possession in this way. It was my brother Dimmick's cane in the first place. The whole box that Joseph's body was brought to Nauvoo in was sawed up into strips suitable to make walking canes of and divided out among his special friends. After the death of Dimmick, the cane became Allen's, who was Dimmick's son, and he told me to take it and keep it until he called for it. He died without calling for it at all. The following is from the Journal of Wilford Woodruff, and it's dated 23rd of August, 1844. I met with the Quorum of the Twelve in council at a little time, or some of them. I visited Emma Smith, the widow of the prophet. She let me have a piece of oak for a staff out of the coffin, and here in his journal he's inserted a diagram or a drawing of a coffin, out of the coffin of the prophet Joseph, who was inhumanly martyred. And here he's inserted a drawing of his king. Inhumanly martyred in Carthage, all in company with his brother Hiram. Emma also let me have a pair of gloves composed of white cotton, and Mrs. Woodruff a pair of cotton handkerchief, both of which the prophet wore while living. We called upon Sister Mary Smith, widow of Hiram Smith, the patriarch. She gave us some hair from the head of Joseph Smith, Hiram Smith, Samuel Smith, and Don Carlos Smith, all brothers of the same parents. I also obtained some hair of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles in the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. My object was in putting a portion of each in the top of my staff as a relic of those noble men, master spirits of the 19th century, to hand down to my posterity, to deposit in the most holy and sacred place in the holy temple of God in the consecrated hill of Zion. As a addition to essentially that statement in the life of Wilford Woodruff, it says these relics he held as something sacred during his lifetime, and they are now in the possession of his family. The History of Mary Fielding Smith by Pearson Corbett also references that same occasion in the giving of the canes. This is out of the life of John D. Lee, talking about the martyrdom and the bodies. They were placed in rough oak plank boxes and brought to the city. There was great lamentation and mourning over them among the people. Joseph was a man dearly loved by the saints and blessed with direct revelation from God, and was an honorable, generous, high-minded man. The remains of the prophet and his brother were laid in a sepulcher made of stone. The rough boards, which once enclosed them, were sawed in pieces and distributed among their friends, many of whom had canes made of the pieces, with a lock of the hair of the prophet set in the top, and those canes are kept as sacred relics to this day. This is from M.R. Werner's book, Brigham Young. The memory of the prophet was perpetrated a few days later. The rough boards, which had been used as temporary coffins, were sawed in pieces and distributed among Joseph's and Hiram's friends, who had canes made of them, each with a lock of the prophet's hair set in the top. These canes are considered sacred relics today. A woman named Sylvia Scoville Roy Lance Blair, a daughter of Lucius Scoville, back in the 1930s for the Federal Writers Project, wrote her life history. And here's what she had to say. Father often told us children of some of his experiences. He was one of the men who helped bury the prophet Joseph Smith. The first coffin they buried him in was of rough oak, and they later made canes of this oak. Each cane had a lock of Joseph Smith's hair set under a small piece of glass and then mounted in silver on top, and the name of a man it belonged to engraved on it. Father always told Mother to keep the cane by her bed, and if she was sick, to put it under her pillow, and it would be a protection for her. After Father's death, the cane was to go to whichever of his children carried on his temple work. My older brother happened to have done more work than I had, so after Father died, the cane went to him. Since my brother's death, though, his wife has had it in her possession, and she has promised to bring it to me when she visits her son in Provo this summer. She is living in Canada at present, and the cane is too valuable to be mailed. I will be glad when it is in my possession. Father said that when they buried the prophet, they always buried him at night. They had a mock funeral one day for him, but the coffin was filled with rocks. The men who buried him were never to disclose the actual place of burial. Three of the men who buried him also have canes in their family possession. These three are Heber C. Kimball of Salt Lake City, and Brother Dibble and Brother Wadsworth of Springville. I don't know how many others there were. And finally, as an additional one, John W. Rigdon, the son of Sidney Rigdon, visited Joseph F. Smith in Salt Lake City in 1900. And the improvement era contained a brief summary of that visit. It describes his appearance, that of John W. Rigdon, and then says, he carried as a souvenir a cane which had been taken from the oaken boxes in which the bodies of Joseph and Hiram were brought from Carthage to Nauvoo after the martyrdom. Steve Barnett wrote an article for BYU Studies several years ago. In fact, he wrote one earlier than that for a religion class at BYU, and then in 1981 wrote an article for BYU Studies where he identified some other Cains. He had some correspondence with the James Byrd family in California and was able to locate a Cain there. He also located an article about Thomas Sessions having a Cain in his possession that once belonged to Peregrine Sessions. Well, I was going to read some more, but I think what we'll do is show some slides. I've been able to locate some of these Cains and have taken photographs of them. Let me first mention that there are Cains that I don't have photographs of that I know exist, but basically these are photographs of the ones that I could get my hands on. Briefly, the Dimmick and then Oliver B. Huntington Cain is in the possession of the church in its church museum. That cane was donated in 1977 by a descendant of May Huntington. I viewed that cane in Springville, Utah in about 1975 or 74. I again saw it shortly after it was donated to the church. In the intervention, the little metal piece of it had been lost over the... Here, I do have a copy of the BYU Studies article written by Steve Barnett, where there is a copy of a photograph of the Huntington Cane. So afterwards, if you'd like to see that one, you're welcome to come up and look at it. Okay, right now I think we'll show some slides and I'll make some comments. I have to remember that there are people who want to view or listen to these tapes, and so I will be more descriptive than I would be if I was up to the screen pointing. The cane you're seeing now is the cane that John W. Rigdon brought with him and donated to Joseph F. Smith in 1900. You will note that it has appears to be an ivory head. It's got a shaft that's about 32 inches long. This particular one had a modern-day rubber tip on the bottom, or at least post-Navut period rubber tip. There's a little escutcheon on the shaft through which a belt loop or hand loop was placed. That escutcheon is very distinctive in that every cane that I have been able to identify has essentially the identical escutcheon on it. The heads vary considerably. Okay, next slide. This is a little better close-up of the head. In this particular one, there was no hair, but in fact a coin that had been engraved by someone, and the coin says, "From Pres B. Young to Sidney Rigdon, 1844. Okay, next slide. You can see that there's some different coloration in the material that the head was made from. I've never had it analyzed, but it appears to be ivory that these heads were made from. Okay, next slide. And here's a close-up of the coin that was embedded in the top of this particular cane. At the time John W. Rigdon donated this cane, he also made an extensive affidavit. Unfortunately, I had access to that once, but either I've lost my copy or never obtained one, but I have read that affidavit. We're having a tough time locating it again. But my recollection is that he indicated this was a prized possession of his father, and that since he prized it so highly, he wanted that to come back into the church. Okay, next slide. This cane presently is in the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers Museum here in Salt Lake City. It's in the Wilford Woodruff case, and it indicates that it belonged to Wilford Woodruff. This cane has no hair in the top. You can see that at one point there was a recess cut and had most probably had hair along with the piece of glass in the head. It matches the Huntington cane and several others except for the glass, and the hair is missing. Okay, next slide. A little closer view of the head of the Wilford Woodruff cane. Next slide. And here you can see that the hair is missing out of that one. Next slide. Heber C. Kimball, in the reference I read, referred to the old black cane of Dr. Willard Richards. There's a painting that hangs in the DUP Museum, as well as a picture that was published in the book Intimate Disciple by Claire Knoll, indicating that the old black cane, which was referred to, is this very cane. That cane is presently in the Daughters Utah Pioneers collection in the Willard Richards case. Next slide. This is another cane that is attributed to Willard Richards. This one is black, but it's a longer length, has no head on it, does not have the distinctive escutcheon on the side where the belt loop goes through. No indication where this cane came from. It's a possibility that this is, in fact, the one. Some others have done some research. By the way, some of these slides are courtesy of Paul Jensen. Paul has been able to photograph. Others I took, and this may, in fact, be the rascal beater that Willard Richards had in the Carthage jail. It's a little tough to document, but that's a possibility. So that would be pre-martyrdom. Okay, next slide. This cane is in the Emma Smith case at the Daughters Utah Pioneer Museum. I have no reference that Emma Smith ever had or kept or made one of these canes or had one made for her. However, this cane was donated by a descendant of the Smiths to the Daughters Utah Pioneer Museum. It bears all of the resemblances and matches perfectly all of the other martyrdom canes, and in all probability is probably one. The head of this is a solid ivory head, has no indentation or no other markings on the head. Okay, next slide. There are several canes and artifacts out of the Daughters Utah Pioneers Museum. In this photograph, I call your attention to the very top one, which is another cane that resides in the Daughters Utah Pioneer Museum. Unfortunately, there is no indication as to who this cane ever belonged to or where it came from. Next slide. Here's a close-up of the head of that cane. This is this and the Huntington cane are the best preserved specimens. This one clearly has the glass in the top with the braided locks of hair set in the top of the cane. Unfortunately, we have no idea who this cane belonged to. Okay, is that all? One more slide. No, that's all of the slides. A couple of more comments. I've been able to... to assemble a list of those that we know had canes. That list would include the following: Wilford Woodruff, Willard Richards, Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, Sidney Rigdon, Oliver B. Huntington, Lucius Scoville, and then Peregrine Sessions, Philo Dibble, Elias Blackburn, and James Byrd. Some question on the James Byrd cane. James Byrd was in all probability the carpenter who made these canes after the martyrdom. The Byrd family has in its possession a cane which it is said was made from the remnants of the second coffins that were made, the ones with the glass plate. Might briefly describe those coffins. The ones that they were actually buried in were made in Nauvoo. These were the wood had been planed. They were finished much more carefully, and they had a hinged glass plate that went over the face, which was the tradition of coffins in that day. And that's the glass that Oliver B. Huntington referred to as being broken when they then disinterred the bodies some months later and moved them up the hill. That glass had apparently been broken and caved in on the bodies. And then we have the rough oak boxes that brought the bodies from Carthage to Nauvoo, and those are apparently the ones that the bulk of these canes were made out of. John D. Lee may have had one. The estate papers of John Taylor mention a cane that in all probability was a martyrdom cane. Other possibilities are those who assisted in the burial of the bodies, Gilbert Goldsmith, Jonathan Holmes. What conclusions can we reach? The conclusions are that there were canes and other artifacts haven't mentioned a couple of other artifacts that were made from the coffins or the rough oak boxes that brought the bodies of Joseph and Hiram from Carthage to Nauvoo. Those shafts or rough pieces of oak were apparently distributed by Emma Smith and Mary Fielding Smith to the friends and associates of Joseph and Hiram. Some of these gentlemen collected hair of either Joseph or Hiram or both, or as Wilford Woodruff indicated, many other people, put that in the top of these canes. These canes were treasured and somehow assumed some healing properties once they arrived in Utah and were used in the healing process. I think too often we criticize other religions and point the finger at Catholics or others who have sacred relics that they attribute some powers to, even healing, or we hear of pilgrimages or great lengths of in other religions to be healed, and yet we have the same kinds of things in our early church history. Thank you.
This is the end of side one.
I assure you that my paper is, or my response to Mr. Fillerup's presentation is not overly long, so there will be plenty of time remaining for questions. I hope, therefore, that you will pay close attention to what I have to say and criticize me duly. I do appreciate Mr. Fillerup's interesting description of these events surrounding the deaths of Joseph and Hiram Smith and the manufacture of the canes. And while I do not intend to devote as much time to the history of the canes as Mr. Fillerup has, I would like to make just a few prefatory comments. One point that I feel could be examined more closely, and it is a point made by Steve Barnett in his 1973 paper, is the fact that we are dealing with at least two types of canes. The majority of the canes mentioned by Mr. Fillerup and those about which we are most informed are those which were fashioned from the strips of the oak coffin in which Joseph had been transported from Carthage to Nauvoo. The various manufacturers of these canes may never be known, nor their methods of manufacture except that which is apparent to the eye. Neither can we know for certain how many canes were thus fashioned, nor who all of the original owners were. Mr. Fillerup has demonstrated the ownership of a number of such canes and has provided us with leads for some others. Now, there is a second class of canes, and those are the three which were fashioned by James Bird, a Nauvoo furniture maker who, according to family tradition, fashioned both the inner and the outer coffins in which the body of Joseph was displayed at the mansion house. Mr. Bird reportedly kept the scraps left over from the two coffins, later compressed them and turned them on a lathe, eventually producing three canes. Two of these canes were given to Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball, while the third was retained by the Bird family and is in their possession today. I have been assured by Mr. Monty Bird, the present owner of the cane, that it is obviously made up from scraps of wood with various graining. Now, I am going to direct most of my remarks to the reputed properties of these canes, and I might preface these remarks by posing the question: are the unusual, even supernatural, properties attributed to these canes applied to both classes of canes, that is, those which were made from the strips of the temporary oak coffin, and those three which were manufactured from the strips of the inner and outer coffins? I am not sure that we have sufficient data available to us to answer that question, but it is one that warrants investigation, and some tentative answers may surface in the course of my remarks. I am intrigued by three things in relation to these canes of the martyrdom. First, the relationships between the original owners and the prophet Joseph Smith as expressed by ownership of such a cane. Secondly, the belief of some Mormons in the purported revelatory or curative powers of these canes. And thirdly, the place of such sacred relics in religion in general, and specifically in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Most accounts refer to these canes as having been given to friends or special friends of the prophet and his family. Certainly the list that Bob gave us here at the end is a list replete with names famous in early Mormon history. Wilford Woodruff reported that he received his cane directly from Emma Smith, Joseph's widow, and that he received locks of hair from the heads of Joseph, Hiram, Samuel Harrison Smith, and Don Carlos Smith from Mary Fielding Smith, Hiram's widow. Some of those involved in the burial process, for example, James Byrd, Dimmick Huntington, or Lucius Scoville, obtained canes themselves through their intimate contact with the materials used in the manufacture. Harry Beardsley, an anti-Mormon writer, in 1931 indicated that the canes were given only to the leaders of the church and that their possession was long regarded as an emblem of rank and authority. Now, it is indeed understandable that the possession of a cane made from the coffin of Joseph Smith and perhaps containing a lock of his hair or that of his brothers would be recognized as a statement of the owner's intimacy with the deceased prophet, with the foundation events of Mormon church history, and perhaps even with authority within the church. Relics of prominent people, their personal effects, even pieces of their clothing have long been treasured by friends, fans, and disciples, and in some instances are used to demonstrate intimacy with the deceased. I am reminded of the current mania in regard to Elvis Presley and of the lady who claims to have in her possession a pair of Elvis's briefs, thus demonstrating her elevated position in the circle of his fans. Despite these perfectly normal interpretations of relic ownership, and despite the fact that rods, canes, staves, and wands have long been used as insignia of office, the available evidence does not support the idea that the original intent of the canes was to convey any such mark of distinction. Rather, as Wilford Woodruff stated, the intent appears to have been simply to produce, quote, a relic of those noble men, master spirits of the 19th century, to hand down to my posterity, end quote. Although some may later have perceived ownership of a cane to represent power and authority, it does not appear that this was ever the original intent of their manufacturer. Instead, they were regarded by their owners as treasured mementos of deceased friends. A number of stories have also arisen regarding unusual mystical powers attributed to the canes, or their use as intermediaries in spiritual healings. Time will not allow here a detailed discussion of the use of rods or canes in obtaining revelation, but a few comments may be in order. We know that in the seventh chapter of the Book of Commandments, Oliver Cowdery was blessed with the gift of, quote, working with the rod, end quote, which would tell him many things. It appears also that Orson Hyde had a revelatory rod of some sort, and the Kimball family tradition records that both Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball were given special rods by Joseph Smith because of their constant faithfulness to him. Kimball, in fact, appears to have occasionally used a rod in obtaining answers to prayer for at least the period from 1844 until 1862, 18 years. He recorded on June 6, 1844, quote, last night I clothed myself and offered up the signs of the holy priesthood and called on the name of the Lord. He heard me, for my heart was made comfortable. I inquired by the rod. It was said my family was well, that my wife would come to me in the East, and that Congress would not do anything for us, end quote. Whether some of the canes of the martyrdom were used in like manner, we do not know for certain. Some family traditions, such as that of the Byrd and Kimball families, indicate that the canes may have been used in obtaining answers to prayer. But to my knowledge, we have no specific recorded account of such an occurrence. We do, however, have several specific references to the canes being used as instruments in faith healings. The concept of mundane physical objects being used as aids in faith healings is at least as old as the Bible. We read especially of scarves and pieces of the Apostle Paul's clothing being sent to the saints in Ephesus for the purpose of healing the sick and casting out devils. Joseph Smith may have been acting along the same lines in 1839 when he reportedly gave a handkerchief to Wilford Woodruff to aid him in administering to some sick children. Woodruff states that he wiped the faces of the children with the handkerchief as instructed by Joseph, and they were indeed healed. Heber C. Kimball stated in 1857 that he had on occasion used his cane while in England for the purpose of healing. Whether this was the cane reportedly given him by James Bird is unknown, as Kimball family tradition records that Heber had three canes in his possession. Kimball, however, also reported that Willard Richards, quote, used to lay his old black cane on a person's head, and that person has been healed through its instrumentality by the power of God, end quote. Note that Kimball here ascribes the healing power to God and refers to the cane as an instrument of that power. Lucius Scoville reportedly told his wife to keep his cane by her bed, or if she was sick, to place it under her pillow, and it would, quote, be a protection for her, end quote. Not only is there little doubt that some of the canes of the martyrdom were used as instruments of healing, but Heber C. Kimball also stated in 1857, quote, the day will come when there will be multitudes who will be healed and blessed through the instrumentality of those canes, and the devil cannot overcome those who have them in consequence of their faith and confidence in the virtues connected with them, end quote. Note once again that Kimball expresses the necessity of exercising faith in God in connection with use of the canes in healing or performing miracles. It is apparent that the canes were regarded by many as instruments of divine power and as sacred relics of considerable import. In fact, Wilford Woodruff stated that he hoped to deposit his cane, quote, in the most holy and sacred place in the holy temple of God on the consecrated hill of Zion, end quote. Now that we have briefly reviewed the use of the canes as possible symbols of intimacy with the prophet, as mementos and as instruments of divine power, it might be appropriate in the few minutes that I have left to examine the canes as sacred relics, and perhaps to briefly discuss the place of relics in religious thought and worship. This question, of course, has much wider application than that found in the case of the canes of the martyrdom, and cannot be treated fully under the present circumstances. This question, in fact, could be properly placed within the scope of current studies in the fields of folk magic and folk religion, as well as the cultural background of early Mormonism. Michael Quinn does, in fact, devote a few pages to a discussion of these canes and related artifacts in his latest book, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. There is, and in fact, a number of photographs in the book that are quite interesting, including a photograph of the candle, of the handle of the John Rigdon cane, showing the inscription from Brigham Young to Sidney Rigdon, 1844, an inscription which personally I find curious and perhaps even a little humorous under the circumstances, post-martyrdom relationship between Brigham Young and Sidney Rigdon. Now, a relic in the religious sense has been defined as, quote, some object such as a part of the body or clothing, an article of personal use or the like, which remains as a memorial of a departed saint, martyr, or other holy person, and as such is carefully preserved and held in esteem or veneration, end quote. Many of us likely have in our possession a relic of some sort, whether of spiritual, familial, or social significance. It may be a photograph of a dear departed, a pair of your great-grandfather's spectacles, or the quilt that some ancestor brought to this country from the old world. Each of these relics evoke unique sentiments to their owners. In the rare book business, we deal with relics on a daily basis, and I never cease to be amazed at the variety of attitudes toward these relics. Some would not hesitate to part with a treasure that may have been in the family for many years, while others would not part with even the most inconsequential item for any price and cannot even talk about such things without shedding a tear. It is not my place to say which sentiment is correct, nor even to pass judgment on the importance and efficacy of these relics in relationship to their owners. Within the same family, there may be a diversity of feeling toward the same heirloom, and yet equal fervency toward the family tradition represented by that heirloom. For some, the relic evokes the memory of a forebearer or a significant event, while others may view the relic merely as a physical object. Relics can be important in worship by rendering perceivable a mystical or spiritually significant event or personage. Furthermore, relics, by partaking physically of the event or personage in question, can serve to tie future generations to the spiritually significant past and the moral and ethical values represented. To paraphrase Constantine Kolokoris, the understanding of worship is incomplete without the observation and interpretation of the relics connected with it. I do not profess to understand all of the mythologies surrounding the canes of the martyrdom. I am, however, interested in them as relics of the past. When I pick up an old book or handle a document signed by Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, perhaps I should say purportedly signed by Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, I cannot help but reflect that I have in my hands something that was once touched by these men. In doing so, I do not consciously attach mystical significance to the object in my hands, and yet somehow I can feel connected with the events and the personalities of the past. It is for this reason that we have museums, libraries, and such, to preserve the artifacts and relics of the past, to enrich our cultural, political, social, and spiritual heritages. Because of the nature of relics, that is, their partaking materially of an event or personage of significance, mystical properties are frequently imputed to them by the credulous. When hearing the comment that the coffin of Joseph Smith has furnished the wood for thousands of canes, one is reminded of the comment that the cross of Christ has furnished enough splinters to build a fleet of ships. And yet some of us have doubtless heard of the miraculous properties attributed to these thousands of splinters purportedly from the cross. Even in Mormon history, we can find numerous instances of miraculous healings being performed through the instrumentality of a cane, a handkerchief, a robe, or an amulet. To me, the key word is instrumentality. When it is understood that the relic in question is being used as an instrument through which the power of God may somehow work, and due credit is given to God for the miracle, I can see little harm in its use. In fact, the relic may serve as a focal point of faith for some, much as when Jesus anointed the blind man's eyes with clay. I doubt that many would ascribe the healing power to the clay rather than to Jesus. Heber C. Kimball has seemed to express this thought in his two statements, which I have already quoted. Skeptic that I am, I cannot view the canes of the martyrdom as possessing any unusual power in and of themselves. Rather, I choose to view them simply as a means by which we can be physically tied to past events and bring to mind the people and the values represented by them. For this reason, the canes of the martyrdom were manufactured. For this reason, they were important mementos to their original and subsequent owners. And for this reason, and in my opinion, for this reason alone, they should be valued today. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Wade. It gave me great satisfaction to understand more fully why I have rescued my great-grandmother's high chair from the desert industry pile three times, the garbage four times, and so I now understand that connection. We have some time for questions, and we want to take advantage of that. If you'll just raise your hand, we'll take you in order. Yes.
Bob, can you tell us about some of the other artifacts besides canes?
Well, many years ago, and some of you may recall this, on Temple Square when they had the museum, there was several glass cases. One of those glass cases had two artifacts that purportedly came from the coffins. One was simply a small square block of wood, and it said, this wood is from the coffin that brought the body of Joseph Smith from Carthage to Nauvoo. The other appeared to be the remnants of a whip handle that had been turned or carved. Again, the knob was missing off of the top of it. It also said that it had been made out of a piece of the coffin of Joseph Smith. Whether that was actually the one that brought his body from Carthage or a remnant that Joseph Bird may have put together or just what that was, I don't know. Those are the only other two relics I know of that purport to claim to be made from the coffins.
Just a follow-up on that. Did they change clothing and put them in their temple robes? And if so, what happened to the clothing? Did it become a relic, the old clothing?
The clothing that Joseph and Hiram had on at the martyrdom? I'm not sure what they were dressed in for their burial, because after the public viewing, they were taken into the back room and prepared for the burial. The outside coffins were filled with the bags of sand. Well, let me back up. The mansion house was closed off. They then removed the coffins and took them into the back room and hid them under a bed. That's with the bodies in them. And then they filled the outside coffins. These are not the rough oak coffins now, but some additional outside coffins that have been built. Filled those with the bags of sand, nailed the boards on top, opened the doors, had the procession where those were taken out and loaded in the wagon and driven to the cemetery. At that point, only a handful of people knew that the bodies were not in those coffins. I'm sure that all of the saints there knew or thought that those bodies were being buried. Willard Richards, of course, gave the funeral sermon. Then they went back and prepared the bodies for burial. Now, I'm not sure what that entailed, but then late that night they took the coffins by this circuitous route round down and finally ended up at the foundation of the Nauvoo House and buried them. I don't know what they're dressed in. As far as the clothing that Joseph and Hiram were wearing at Carthage, I do know that some of the clothing that Hiram was wearing is currently in possession of his descendants, and the Reorganized Church has some of the clothing that Joseph was wearing.
When the bodies were moved uphill in 1929, photographs taken then would indicate that they built new boxes for them. Do you know if any of the old coffins down toward the river a little bit further, any parts of wood were found or laid over the cave?
Yes, there are some descriptions of finding, again, some pieces of glass, and I think they found a remnant of a hinge and a couple of pieces of wood in 1928, when the bodies were, the purported bodies were disinterred and moved to their present location. That's a whole different subject, but I'm absolutely convinced that those were not the bodies of Joseph and Hiram that were disinterred and moved in 1928. So you'll have to come next year and hear that paper, I guess.
You want pictures?
I may.
Any further questions? Yes.
Are the families that have these items, are they, usually pretty willing to let you see them and examine them? Or is there a chance that, sometimes they could get a few of these things together so, those of us who have not been as privileged to get them could see them?
I only know of two families who currently have a cane in their possession that I've been able to identify as one of these canes. That's the Kimball family and the Bird family. I've not had any communication with the Bird family. Wade has recently, and I know that the Kimball family understands what they have, but I'm not sure that those members that have it want that broadcast about. As far as the others, I think they've simply disappeared, and I've gone to great efforts to try to locate some of these and have been unsuccessful. I had a descendant of Elias Blackburn tell me that that her grandfather, which was also a descendant of Elias, had this cane, and he knew what it was. Where that is now presently, I don't know. This old gentleman has passed away, and I'm not sure where that particular cane is, but she knew what it was, and her grandfather knew what it was. I have no idea where the Scoville cane or some of these others may even be at the present time.
My brother Montford has in his possession one of those canes. He brought it to a family reunion in Knott on Memorial Day this year. Over 130 people viewed it. He didn't leave it on a display table, but people were welcome to feel it. It's not a fancy cane. It doesn't have an ivory top. It's clearly made with shavings. We've never associated any miracles or unusual healing power with that, and this is all new information to me.
Well, now you have it straight from a member of the Bird family, so...
I might say that I did talk with Monty Bird just 2 nights ago, I guess, because he lives in my hometown, as a matter of fact. And he was very, very kind and very willing to talk about the cane and very open about it. I imagine if he was deluged by a number of inquirers, that might change. But I think the family is actually proud to some degree of that particular tradition.
I would mention, I think what this lady asked is, her question was, can they work if she see a cane today? There are either 4 or 5 predominant Utah pioneers here in Salt Lake, and you just have to go from one window to another, but they won't touch it.
Yeah, those are all enclosed, but they are available for the public. The Wilford Woodruff, the Willard Richards one, we're just not sure which one it is, the Emma Smith one, and then the one with the hair in the top, which is simply in a case by itself. They have no record of where they got that cane or who donated it, and as a consequence, we can't tell who owned it. Any other questions? Okay, the question was, if people believe that these canes had healing powers, when does the cane lose its healing power, or are they still used today? I don't know of any use of any of these canes today in any healing mode. I don't know anything. I don't know whether they had healing powers in and of themselves. I think Wade has addressed that issue, or only were they instrumentalities. I simply view it as a curious insight into the early Mormon history and the love that some of these men had for their fallen prophet and patriarch. Beyond that, I'm not sure whether they in and of themselves have any inherent power. David.
Is there any indication that the hair of Joseph or Hiram was removed after the martyrdom in order to provide these relics?
Well, that's what Oliver B. Huntington said in his account, that when they were disinterred to be moved up the hill, that the glass had broken and that they removed some of the pieces of glass as well as some of the locks of hair at that time, and that's what they put. Now we have Wilford Woodruff then collecting samples of hair from from Mary Fielding Smith. Where she got those, I don't know. As you'll recall, she was not in attendance at the disinterment and reburial, and in fact had some consternation that went on without her knowledge. She knew that it was going to happen, but was apparently no one invited her to attend that, and she was not too pleased with that, and I imagine I wouldn't have been either. And so I don't know if somebody cut some extra hair at that point and then gave it to her later, or whether she collected this during their lifetime or before they were buried. Simply don't know. I might mention that also in the Willard Richards case up at the Daughters Utah Pioneers Museum, I just discovered is a locket that it says Willard Richards wore around his neck, that is also, it has glass on both sides. It has a little, appears to be a silver, tarnished silver frame around it, accompanied by a chain, but it's full of braided hair of all sorts and sizes and kinds, with no indication as to who that belonged to. There are various pieces of hair of Joseph and Hiram around. In the Emma Smith case up at the DUP Museum, there are, as I recall, 2 samples purporting to be hair taken from Joseph Smith. No indication as to when, pre- or post-martyrdom. I don't know how many of you have been through the Beehive House and seen some of those those flowers and pictures that the daughters of Brigham made out of the hair in their cutting. So this was a very prominent thing to preserve back at that time period, to preserve hair and locks of hair of famous people and collect those, like we kind of do autographs. They would collect samples of hair and preserve them.
Any further questions? Yes.
The question was, would that healing power be considered witchcraft? I suppose my answer is Mike Quinn is the one who ought to respond to that question, not me.
We thank Robert and Wade again. We thank you for being here. I've learned a great deal, and I hope you have likewise. Thank you.
This is the end of this cassette.